Iran has dealt with drought before, but not like this, and not in the capital, Tehran, home to more than 10 million people.
This is the first time that the most populous and economically and politically powerful city in Iran is facing a situation like this.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, what's behind the water crisis in Iran? And connected to that, UN climate change talks begin in Brazil. Attendees are all looking at the real impact on people's lives.
Whether it's cheaper energy, less pollution, better health, and more jobs, that has become absolutely sacrosanct.
And we swoon over dessert from a Polish bakery.
Kind of dense, very moist in the middle, very sugary, crusty, crunchy on the outside. Mm. It's a unique texture.
Yeah, give me a dozen to go. Today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Carolyn Beeler has a day off. Glad you could be with us. We start this Monday in Iran, which is dealing with its worst drought in decades. The dam that supplies water to Tehran, the capital, has dropped below 10% capacity. Things are so bad in the city that authorities have started rationing water, one of several extreme measures. Iran's government has even suggested evacuating Tehran's population of nearly 10 million people. Kaveh Madani was once deputy head of Iran's Department of Environment. He's now based in Toronto, where he directs the United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment, and Health. We spoke earlier today, and I asked Madani how bad this current drought is for Iran.
It is the most serious shortage I can recall. I grew up in Tehran. That's my hometown, the capital of Iran, and it has never been like this. It always had its steady water supply to all the residents. It's a city of more than 10 million people. And there were some interruptions during dry years, but that was when I was a kid. But it was never this bad, with reservoirs empty, groundwater levels also low. And we never remember talking about day zero in Iran, in Tehran especially. And now Tehran is not alone. It's also some other big metropolitans that are experiencing the same thing. In the past, Iran had water shortages. But this is the first time that the most populous, economically and politically powerful city in Iran is facing a situation like this.
Kaveh, you mentioned day zero. What does that signify?
Day zero is the day that cities' taps would be absolutely dry and there is no water to supply. And what we are seeing right now is days of water left, maybe weeks in the most optimistic view, weeks of water left in the reservoirs to supply to the city resident. And for the background, in the water sector in California or in Iran, we first start with cutting from the environment, then agriculture, then industries, and cities and urban sectors are last resort. And that's what is happening right now. Already water outages and interruptions have started. Some level of rationing, some reduced pressure, and with the encouragement of the residents to reduce water consumption, but that might not solve the problem unless there is rain.
Well, I mentioned how the dam that supplies Tehran with water is down to 10% of capacity and dropping. Iran's second city of Mashhad is down to less than 3% of its water supply. How did all of this happen?
There are two things. When you have an extreme situation, a wildfire, a drought, people always use climate change as the first one to blame, right? The first driver of the situation. But Iran has been suffering from poor management, decades of bad management, lack of foresight in the water sector, not appreciating water as a limit to growth and continuing growth without paying attention. Similar to the U.S. West model, building dams, relying on groundwater, relying on surface water, relying on desalination and interbasin water transfer to promote development, a situation like what we have seen in Los Angeles, that first people pick a location to live in, and then you think about bringing water to the residents. It works for a while, as long as infrastructure is there and water is there to move. But after a while, that solution would not be sufficient and sustainable. So all of those were there to create a very unreliable situation. So let's say that the house was already on fire because of mismanagement and climate change and drought added fuel to that fire. Now the flames are everywhere and they no longer can be denied.
Kaveh, what have been the directions given by the government? In California, we're familiar with bans on watering lawns, washing cars. When it gets really bad, you know, limiting your time in the shower. Have people in Tehran been given directions on how to conserve water?
To give you context, we don't have many lawn irrigation in Tehran. Tehran is full of high rises and apartments,
right.
But some have pools and so on. So, they have been advised not to wash their cars or streets with water, not to fill pools. But again, it's very hard to regulate in such a situation. And government is also very afraid of not making the citizens angry. So they only go to people when they have a serious fear. Over the summer, we also had concerns about getting close to the day zero. But some people were hopeful that changing the water year would change, also flip the coin and there would be more rain. Now that it hasn't rained for 6 weeks, there is a serious concern that the situation would not get any better. And that's why we have even threats of evacuation of Tehran.
I was going to ask you, I mean, one of the most extreme measures for Tehran that's been suggested and is being discussed is evacuating the city, a city of 9 to 10 million people. How realistic is that?
I don't think that is a realistic thing because it's shutting down the capital of the country, the most economically, you know, important and significant city of the country, is not possible. Yet the government has tried something that's very unique to Iran, that during polluted days where the air pollution is high or during the peak times of electricity use in summer, they have tried to prolong the weekends and shut down schools and offices and encourage people to leave the big cities. And believe it or not, this has been an effective a measure in reducing consumption and helping them manage the situation. So I assume they would try the same if the situation is going to get worse. But let's not forget that many other cities outside Tehran are facing the same situation. Right. But if you only have like a few days or a few weeks of water left in your system, even saving for a day can make a huge difference until rain comes.
So we spoke earlier about what or who is responsible for this crisis. How do you imagine Iranian people will see this? Will they place the blame on the climate or their government?
The majority of people think that the government is accountable, and I think that is correct, not only in Iran, but anywhere else in the world. It's always the governments who have to perceive these things, predict and project and get prepared for the situation. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on which side you belong to, the government of Iran doesn't have the chance to really blame this on climate change.
Kaveh Madani is the director of the United Nations University Institute for Water, Environment, and Health in Toronto. Plumes of smoke, shattered windows, mangled and burned out vehicles, but few answers. That's after a car explosion in Delhi, India, this evening local time. Authorities said that 8 people were killed. At least 19 more were injured in the blast that then triggered a fire. The cause is being investigated by Indian authorities. New Delhi's international airport, metro stations, and government buildings were also put on a high security alert. The explosion took place near the famous Red Fort in Delhi. It's a former imperial palace and one of India's most high-profile tourist attractions. We'll keep following developments about this news in the days ahead. In November of 2023, hundreds of earthquakes shook the southwest of Iceland. They sent fractures running through the ground in Grindavik, a coastal village with a thriving fishing industry. 2 years ago today, Iceland's government ordered the town's 3,800 residents to evacuate. Raquel Lind Rafsdottir was one of them. She spoke with us a few months after that order when lava actually started flowing into the town.
I have hope that I hold on to, that I can go back. But right now, I'm not sure.
This past summer, the world's Carolyn Beeler met up with Hrafnsdottir to see the town where she was born and raised and to hear about how people there are doing 2 years since the quakes.
Hrafnsdottir met me in her candy apple red pickup truck to show me around Grindavik.
The crack that opened November 10th is under here, under all of the...
She's pointing through the windshield to a parking lot off a main residential street.
And under the houses, that's why the house is like this one, it's falling.
It's tilted.
Yeah,
And this one here too. You see how it goes like
other
end? Yeah.
It looks like it's built onto a hill, but it was flat before. It's just the earth has heaved up underneath one edge of it.
Yeah.
She says inside those damaged houses are like carnival fun houses, all sloping floors and wonky door frames. The houses are surrounded by tall metal fencing to show they're condemned.
And it's not going to be built anything here ever again, not on this spot.
A relatively small number of buildings here, 30 to 40, will have to be demolished. More need repairs, like the elder care home and the indoor soccer stadium. Parts of the town sank after the earthquakes, and Hrafnstóttir points out a rift where the ground is about 3 feet higher on one side than the other. We brave the gusting wind to see the restaurant where she worked in her 20s.
So what are we looking at here?
Here is, in back of the restaurant, we have like a lot of sinkholes around at the back.
After earthquakes split the ground open in November, volcanic eruptions sent lava flowing into the town in January.
There were three houses that went under, this one here, and one more that lava went all over. So there's nothing.
Nothing left. That house went up in flames. The river of now-cooled lava stands taller than me. It cuts across a residential street, cordoned off with more fencing and warning signs. The jagged black lava rock now wraps neatly around the corner of a wooden fence surrounding a house that was untouched.
The house owner, they believe that hidden people protect the houses.
Like fairies?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean by hidden people?
Yeah. It was amazing that it just stopped there without burning the fence or anything.
Most of the buildings in town stand empty. Some restaurants and shops, the health clinic and schools. Some need repairs before they can reopen, including the schools. That's why Hrafnstóttir and her family haven't moved back yet.
I can't live here because my kids need school. So we're kind of just waiting to get schools going on and then we can move back.
Hrafnstóttir and I are at her house, where she returns frequently to check on things. But right now, she and her family are living in a suburb of Reykjavik.
Every time I come here, I open every window because you can smell like it's like a heavy.
As she walks around, she points out the earthquake damage.
There's just little cracks here and there.
Snaking up the walls and along the bathroom tile. One of the bedrooms at the back of the house is sloping downward from the hallway.
On this end, the floor has a little bit sinked.
I can tell it looks like we're looking down into this room a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's always more and more, but you can fix that. And you can fix this house.
So what is it like for you to come back to your house that's all empty, all the furniture is away, it's kind of echoing in here? Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it makes me sad. I don't always come to my house. I just drive through town or go to a soccer game or something. Because the empty house reminds me that I can't stay here.
While Grindavik's residents are scattered, sports are the thing bringing them together. Hrafnstóttir mentioned the soccer game. The first winter after Grindavik was evacuated, it was the basketball team playing their season on a borrowed court that kept the town together. She helps run that team.
People that not even used to go to basketball games, they were coming to basketball games just to meet other people from Grindavik. So it was the basketball that kept getting that together, the community.
That community is returning to the town, but slowly.
I'm sure that we can make Grindavik again, but it will take time.
It will help to have the schools reopen. Officials say that could happen next fall. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Grindavik, Iceland.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. At the gateway to the Amazon rainforest in Brazil is the city of Belém. It's hosting the annual UN Conference of the Parties, the international gatherings on climate change. But at this 30th COP meeting, there are serious questions about the effectiveness of COP and what could come out of this two-week conference. Megan Rowling is based in Barcelona, where she's an editor at Climate Home News and is heading to Belém in a few days. She spoke with us about the issues on the table this year.
One of the big issues is the gap between the emissions reductions that have been promised by countries in their new national climate change plans. And so far, those only add up to a reduction of about 12% in emissions. However, what's needed to keep global warming to the targets of the Paris Agreement is a cut more along the lines globally of 60%. So that's one big issue. Another issue is how to help people cope better with the extreme weather, whether it's Hurricane Melissa in Jamaica or big typhoon that's just hit the Philippines. So that is one area where we're expected to see some progress towards a global goal on adaptation. And I'd say the third issue, which is linked to that, is how do you pay for it? How do you pay for all of this, which is called climate finance? And even though we got a new climate finance goal last year at the COP, this is still way off what countries say they're going to be needing.
With the many diverse countries in attendance in Belém, I mean, they, of course, have different pressures on their ability to reduce emissions. I can imagine there are already points of contention or disagreement already happening. What have you heard?
There are a lot of discussions always within these talks about who should make the biggest effort, who should provide the finance. And so in the past, there's often been a big division between rich countries and poorer countries, developed and developing. We've seen that become a little bit more fluid in recent years with the rise of some of the larger emerging economies, both in terms of the climate change that they're causing with their emissions, such as China. And, you know, obviously a lot of these countries are also becoming richer. So that stark divide has eased off a little bit. And also with the US not sending a delegation, as far as we know, to this COP, and obviously stepping away from its commitments under the Paris Agreement, that leaves a lot of the heavy lifting for now to be done by the European Union and some of these bigger developing countries.
How is it shaking out at the negotiations in terms of leadership?
Well, some people, I would say, think that it's not such a bad thing that President Trump hasn't sent high-level officials to the COP this time. So without the US, in some ways, it allows countries that clearly want to pursue climate action, that they can just kind of get on and do their job. And it also opens up space for some of the bigger global South countries to take a bigger role as well.
The Brazilian government says it wants this meeting to be about implementation, not negotiation. But implementation happens on a domestic level. The COPs are negotiations by definition. So how would implementation even be directed or work?
I think what the UN climate process wants to do is work harder on making the links between, you know, the rarefied world of the talks, which is full of jargon and process, and what's actually happening in the real economy. The UN climate chief is saying in practically every speech he makes now that this is about making a positive difference to people's lives, whether it's cheaper energy, less pollution, better health, and more jobs. That has become absolutely sacrosanct to what happens at the COPs themselves, so that people understand that, you know, that it really is important to how we all live our lives.
You know, people who closely follow climate change news have heard the UN Secretary General's declaration that we've blown past the 1.5 degrees Celsius limit. How does that pessimism appear at these conferences that are supposed to be about finding global solutions?
I don't think that kind of pessimism is something that most people who go to the climate change talks really believe, that, you know, it's too late. This is very much not the message that's coming from the UN, actually. The UN has said in the run-up to this climate conference that it's likely that global warming will overshoot 1.5°C, which was the lowest limit in the Paris Agreement. But what they're saying now is is that even if that happens, that the effort now should be to bring it back down again. So bring the temperature overshoot back down to 1.5. And that is eminently possible with the technologies that we have. It's a question of political will. So I think it's more of a kind of realism that this is the first time the UN has admitted in the run-up to a COP that, yes, that 1.5C target will be exceeded very likely, but it's still possible to bring temperatures back down again if enough effort is made. But, you know, to be fair, that would have to mean a step change in what governments and businesses are doing.
Right. Megan, most people will never attend a global climate negotiation. Just it's something so far removed from the daily realities of our lives. But break it down for us. How do the outcomes of these meetings impact the lives of the general public?
So the decisions that are made at the COP meetings are, you know, very much setting the tone for then what governments go away and do for the next year. It sets the direction. It shows governments where they need to be heading for. And then every 5 years, governments have to come up with a new national climate plan called a nationally determined contribution, the NDCs. And we're seeing the latest round, the third round of those NDCs coming out this year. Not all countries have submitted them yet. But in those plans, they explain how they're going to cut emissions, how they're going to adapt to climate change. And so it very much then that feeds back into national level policies, sometimes into laws, into regulations. And that's how that then filters down through the government structures to the lives of ordinary people.
Megan Rowling is an editor at Climate Home News based in Barcelona. She's heading to Belém, Brazil in a few days. Stay with The World this week for more coverage of the COP30 climate conference. Spectators at last night's Canadian Premier League soccer match got way more than they bargained for.
Anyone's to claim in the air. Bicycle! Oh, my God! Asso! The most incredible goal in CPL history!
A blistering bicycle kick by Atletico Ottawa's David Rodriguez, as a very stoked announcer explained there on the One Soccer Network. This particular and very rare maneuver has now been dubbed not the bicycle kick, but the icicle kick, because Rodriguez pulled it off as 5 inches of snow fell during the game. They actually stopped play every 15 minutes to shovel it away, just so officials could see the lines on the pitch.
We got a tie game in the snow in Ottawa, our nation's capital.
Rescheduling the match due to snow was not an option because of the rigorous competition schedule. That icicle kick, though, it proved to be a huge boost for Atletico Ottawa. They defeated Cavalry FC of Calgary 2-1. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Voters in Iraq head to the polls tomorrow to choose a new parliament. Lawmakers who win seats in that body will then select the country's president and prime minister. For more than 40 million Iraqis, this is their chance to have a say in their country's future. But many say they won't be voting at all. One powerful Shiite cleric is even calling on its followers to boycott the election. From Baghdad, Duri Biskaran reports.
Campaign season has turned the streets of Baghdad into tunnels of color, as billboard after billboard advertises stern-looking faces and promises of change.
The goal of most of Iraqis is to fight corruptions, a new government, changing some parts of the constitutions and laws in Iraq for good.
I'm working with longtime Iraqi journalist Awad Altai as he brings me to an overpass near the Baghdad Zoo. From here, we can see campaign billboards representing the full spectrum of Iraqi politics.
Sunni parties, seculars, and liberals, communists, and Islamists, Shia also.
It's a crowded field this year, with nearly 8,000 candidates vying for the parliament's 329 seats. There are green signs for a Sunni coalition, yellow for a former prime minister.
It says power and prosperity.
Light blue signs belong to the centrist coalition Al Furatin, which supports the sitting prime minister. Their logo is a construction crane.
The crane also represents the coalition of the development and reconstruction. The prime minister works a lot to build and rebuild many projects.
Attracting foreign investments to rebuild Iraq after years of war. Less frequently, you'll see a bright yellow sign with black writing. That one represents a party associated with Qatab Hezbollah, a powerful militia backed by Iran. They aren't expected to win many seats, but enough to still be a player in parliament. In a nearby park, Tamara Khalid plays badminton with her teenage kids. She's a primary school teacher, so she says she and her family will vote for a candidate who already leads the education ministry. She says he's already helped improve facilities for kids with disabilities and renew classrooms. He deals with us directly, she says. There's no bureaucracy between us and him. We trust him to make a change. There's a record number of women and candidates from minority groups running for office this year. Hundreds who are running as independents, representing no party, just themselves. Election advocates hope these options will encourage voters to participate, but many say they're sitting this one out. Rania, a college student who asked to be identified only by her first name while discussing politics, says she won't vote for anyone. In the future, when something bad happens, I don't want to be responsible because I voted for this person, she says.
Many Iraqis have recognized that elections aren't actually really about democratic change or change in any case.
Vinad Mansour, a senior research fellow at London-based Chatham House, says that since the U.S. invasion in 2003, elections were considered the pulse of Iraq's democracy. But reality has fallen short of expectations, and deep sectarian divides still prevent the government from serving all Iraqis equally.
It's been the same leaders who will always come back together and recycle or reshuffle their chairs, effectively, their positions within the state.
The last parliamentary elections in 2021 had just a 41% national turnout rate. Protesters supporting the militias demanded a recount, and violent clashes with security forces left dozens dead. It took 11 months for the parliament to establish its governing coalition. A survey by the Al-Mustaqila Group for Research in Iraq suggests that this year's turnout rate could be even lower. But Mansour says the last few years have been stable for Iraq. Oil prices have remained high. The country's leaders have focused on rebuilding infrastructure and domestic issues instead of getting involved in nearby conflicts like Israel's war on Gaza.
When the war began, they sort of took a pause and showed some kind of restraint because they've come to the conclusion that being part of the Iraqi state was far more lucrative and legitimizing than being part of any kind of external resistance axis.
Mansour says the question remains, is this period of calm superficial, buoyed by the economy, a mirage?
Or is this something more sustainable that's being built by the coordination framework in Baghdad?
Hassam al-Rudani is a human rights lawyer in Baghdad. Through a translator, he tells me how he spent the past months going to universities, trying to convince people to turn up at the polls.
They thought by not taking part in elections, they would bring down the whole political process because they have a distrust.
People have lost faith in the process, he says, but he makes his case for voting anyways.
Any kind of change you're hoping for should go through the ballot box. It's not going to be through military coups. It's not going to be through big revolutions. It's not going to be through any violent process against the government, against the country. It should be through elections.
Even if they're far from perfect. For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin, Baghdad.
In Spain's northern Basque country, street violence has been erupting since the summer. Groups of young mass protesters have been looking for fights with the police. It's all a reminder of the political violence that gripped Spain for decades. The Basque separatist group known as ETA waged an armed struggle for independence and murdered hundreds of people. This recent spate of political violence has many wondering if the region is making a dark return to that past. As The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona, this generation of agitators has a wide range of demands.
In the Basque language, the term for street fighting is kale borroka, Beginning in the 1980s, it became inextricable from ETA's armed struggle. The modus operandi was always the same. Crowds of mostly young men, their faces covered, would take over the streets, burning stuff, vandalizing storefronts, scuffling with the police. It was low-intensity terrorism, says Fernando Baquero Oroquieta, an expert and author of several books on Basque unrest. ETA used the Kale Borroka as a way of recruiting and training young people into its ranks, he says, and as a way of keeping the society on edge. ETA was the armed wing of a Basque separatist movement launched in 1959, during the years of the Franco dictatorship. By the time it laid down its arms in 2011, ETA assassins had killed more than 800 people, including soldiers, police, and civilians. In 2018, it formally disbanded. By then, many of its members were in jail, others entered mainstream politics, and the Kale Borroka stopped, pretty much until this summer. It reappeared at an unlikely time and place, near the finish line of one leg of the Tour de France bicycle race in the Basque city of Bilbao. Lots of people were already out protesting against Israel, waving Palestinian flags, when a group of violent young masked men pushed into the street and brought the bikes to a halt. The words Kale Borroka were suddenly back in the headlines. The following day, a reporter asked Spain's interior minister, Fernando Grande Marlaska, if any known Kale Borroka characters were among those detained after the police arrived. "You know there were not," the minister said, looking exasperated. Analysts and academics who study Spanish political violence say Grande Marlaska was right, technically speaking. Jérôme Ferré is a full professor of sociology at the University of Toulouse in southwest France. Kale Borroka existed when it was linked to ETA, he says, and since ETA no longer exists, the phenomenon has disappeared by definition. The phenomenon meaning ETA using young people to stir up trouble. But though the puppet master is gone, so to speak, it seems a new generation of Basques has learned how to bring on the fight on its own. According to his research, Ferré says, young Basques aren't focused on independence from Spain, as was ETA. They're angry about the high cost of housing, an unstable job sector, and gender discrimination. Ferré says these young fighters do have a political enemy, but it isn't the central government. It's Spain's far-right parties, which have been growing in popularity. Last month in the Basque city of Vitoria, young men went fist-to-fist with a group of far-right extremists who'd come out to eulogize the late dictator Francisco Franco on the 50th anniversary of his death. The fighting has gotten intense during some altercations, but Ferré says these groups are very small and they're diverse, says author Fernando Vaquero Oroquieta. Some do want independence from Spain, others amnesty for ETA prisoners. Still others are pushing for a Marxist revolution.
Entienden que no, que sus padres no han conseguido la revolución, no han conseguido la independencia.
They understand that their parents never got their revolution off the ground, he says. They didn't achieve independence. And on top of that, they're aware that they're going to be worse off economically than their parents, where conditions are more and more precarious, he says. The middle class is disappearing, as is the once high status of the working man. If the term Kale Borroka stirs up frightening memories in Spain, so does the idea of communism for some. Fears of a leftist takeover helped spark Spain's devastating civil war back in the 1930s. So images of young Basque communists street fighting with police have become political fodder for attacking Spain's current socialist government.
Esto es suicida para la nación entera.
Isabel Ayuso, the conservative leader of the Madrid region, said recently that socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez was using the Basque violence to stay in power. It's suicide for the nation, she said. But both Baquero and sociology professor Ferré stressed that the Basque street violence will likely remain sporadic and without a unifying cause, even if it harkens back to the national traumas of war and separatist terror. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
A painting by Frida Kahlo is going to the auction block later this month, and it is causing a stir. If predictions bear out, the surrealist painting could become the most expensive work by any female or Latin American artist ever. Estimates range from $40 million to $60 million. Kahlo painted El Sueño, La Cama, or The Dream, The Bed, in 1940. It depicts a woman under a yellow blanket asleep in a canopy bed with a skeleton laying on top of the canopy. In Mexico, Kahlo's work is covered by special legal protections and cannot be sold, or destroyed for that matter. This painting, however, is held in a private collection abroad, so it is eligible to be put up for sale internationally. A court in Italy has rejected the government's ambitious plan to build one of the longest suspension bridges in the world. The long-debated multi-billion-dollar bridge project aims to connect Sicily to the Italian mainland, replacing a much longer trip by ferry for people and goods. The court did not give a reason for its decision. Italy's infrastructure minister has pledged to keep fighting for the construction project. Aside from the cost of the bridge, critics are concerned about the people who will be displaced during its construction. DW correspondent Angela von Schaik has been speaking with some of those who could lose their homes.
A questa tragedia che incombe, piacere. Fiorella.
Fiorella. Fiorella is 85 years old and lives in the hills above the city of Messina. She owns a beautiful villa with a great view of the Strait of Messina. Calabria, the Italian mainland, is so close it feels like you could touch it.
Signora Fiorella.
She's been living here for more than 50 years.
Perché l'idea che io debba lasciare,
that someone is ordering me to leave this place after 54 years, I don't like that one bit, she says.
Non mi va bene.
Fiorella lives in one of the roughly 300 houses in Sicily that are set to be demolished to make way for the construction of the bridge over the Strait of Messina. In the place where her house now stands, a viaduct will be built to connect the bridge to the existing highway. And a bit further downhill, she lives at an elevation of about 300 meters, one of the bridge's pillars will be erected. Driving around his own neighborhood, Daniele Jalacqua from the No Ponte, so the No Bridge movement, shows the impact the bridge will have on the city. The houses in front of me, he says, all villas of around 200 square meters with a garden, have to be demolished. Just like this beautiful Liberty Villa from the early 20th century. There, a pillar will be built, one of the two that's going to support the bridge. With a circumference of about 50 meters and almost 400 meters high. In comparison, the Eiffel Tower in Paris is 300 meters in height. The bridge, with a capital B, has been a subject of debate for decades. Italy's Minister of Infrastructure, Matteo Salvini, is now pushing to move forward with its construction. But there are serious doubts about the technical feasibility of the project.
Sulla base di quello che ho detto fino adesso e da quello che sostengo con I materiali attuali.
With today's materials, you can build a bridge, but there is no safety guarantee, says Antonio Risitano, engineer and former professor at the Polytechnic University of Turin. The bridge might stand, but it won't be reliable. From the very first moment until the end of its 200-year lifespan, the bridge should be equally safe. But with the materials currently available, steel and concrete, that level of safety cannot be guaranteed. The main argument in favor of the bridge is that a faster connection to the mainland would benefit the Sicilian economy. But given the shift from road to sea transport for goods, even that claim is questionable, says Guido Signorino, economics lecturer at the University of Messina. The big question then is, why does this bridge really need to be built?
Quello che è evidente è che ogni volta che il progetto è stato.
It seems that there are major economic interests behind the scenes, pushing for the construction of the bridge, says the professor. Or, at the very least, for reviving the project whenever the opportunity arises. That's what happens time and again. Despite the shaky technical and economic foundations of the bridge, there are apparently companies pressuring politicians, particularly those on the right, to see the project through. Reportedly, the construction companies stand to receive hefty compensation, running into the hundreds of millions, even if the project is never completed. Meanwhile, the threat of expropriation continues to loom over the residents. If you have to leave, Where are you going?
Ma infatti, assolutamente,
I wouldn't know where to go outside of this corner of paradise, she says.
Il paradiso dove sto.
Last week's decision by the Italian Court of Auditors has granted the residents a reprieve. But it is likely to only be brief. Italy's infrastructure minister Matteo Salvini has all but staked his political career on the project, and he is determined to appeal. Emerging from an emergency government meeting last Thursday, Salvini declared his confidence that work would begin again in February, once the court's concerns had been answered point by point. The message was clear. Despite legal setbacks, protests, the doubts of engineers, and the devastation of a unique natural environment, this bridge is going to be built, one way or another. Angelo von Schaik, DW, Messina, Italy.
You're listening to The World. It is fall, which means you can fire up your oven again and also enjoy its radiant heat. Maybe knead some of your feelings into a hearty ball of bread dough. For some baking inspiration, we turn to baker and writer Laurel Kratochwila, who just published the cookbook Dobre Dobre, Baking from Poland and Beyond. She spoke recently with The World's Carolyn Beeler.
Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome, Laurel.
Thank you for having me.
So you start your book with a quote that I would also like to start this interview with. You write, "I fell in love with Polish baking because I didn't like the pickles in the Czech Republic." Please explain.
Well, so what do pickles have to do with Polish baking? Well, about 18 years ago, I found myself living in the Czech Republic, and I was so disappointed to find that the pickles in the Czech Republic are sweet. And I've been hoping for some real sour pickles, you know, Central Eastern Europe, this is like the land of pickles. And I started dating a guy. I think it was our second date. He said, "Well, if you don't like the pickles here, let me take you to Poland." And it seemed like such a ludicrous idea, but it was really about, I don't know, an hour and a half drive. We get to the other side. We were near this town called Jelenia Góra. First fruit and vegetable stand we saw, we just pulled over, and they sell loose pickles. And I was so happy. And then I saw a bakery. And we had to go into the bakery. And in the bakery, I was so surprised to see just like a shelf full of challah. I recognized this. It was like being home, you know, being in like a good Jewish bakery in New England or New York. And I think that was my first moment of, aha, this is the country where I find the food that's familiar to me, that I love, that touches upon nostalgia, because I really felt at home through that experience.
You wrote that the challah tasted like the challah that you grew up on. You are Jewish. You have Polish heritage. I'm curious kind of like why this surprised you, I guess, that this existed in Poland.
What surprised me about it is that it was in a context that was not Jewish, right? So you would find challah in a Jewish bakery. I mean, you get it in a grocery store, of course, but it is a Jewish bread. And here I was in rural Poland, no Jews in this region for who knows how long, and there's challah. And I think that is what made it exciting and surprising to me, and just kind of opened a little Pandora's box that made me want to look more.
So I think it's high time that we talk some recipes. Hannah's apple cake, or Hannah's apple cake, the recipe for that is on our website, theworld.org. Can you tell me the story behind that recipe?
Hannah's apple cake. So first of all, there's 10 recipes in the book that are contributed from other bakers, both in Poland and of Polish or Polish Jewish origin around the world. And Hannah's one of them. She's based in London. But this is her grandmother's apple cake, and it started in Lublin. That's where her grandmother was born. It was a family recipe and spans the whole 20th century, right? Because First, they left Lublin as economic migrants to Vienna, and then Kristallnacht happened, right? And they moved to, I believe it was Paris, and then Casablanca, and then all the way South America. They were in Montevideo, they moved to Texas, and finally, you know, we're talking three generations later, Hannah lives in London, and her grandmother passed down this recipe for her when she was hosting her first Rosh Hashanah. It's this wonderfully kind of dense, very moist in the middle, very sugary, crusty, crunchy on the outside. Mm. It's a unique texture.
You're making me hungry.
maybe this is the first one you'll make out of the book, but it's such a good example of the diasporic nature mm-hmm. of Polish baking and how it's moved around the world and changed a little as it's gone, right? So her grandmother would have just used regular oil in this, whereas Hannah changed it up a little, modernized it a bit, and she uses olive oil and brown sugar. And it just gives it this little extra something. Yet at its essence, it's the recipe from Lublin. Mm.
Yeah, other recipes in your book have stories like this one, recipes being passed down, crossing borders, being tweaked. I'm wondering mm-hmm. if there are, you know, kind of the fingerprints of that movement in any of the other recipes, ingredient changes, things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I played around with a few recipes. You know, I have very updated bialy with a horseradish cream and spring vegetables. And then also there is a chef in Melbourne who he works in the fine dining world. His name is Zachary Leon First. And what he likes to do is take like a classical Polish recipe that some very often things that his grandparents made and adapt it for that fine dining environment. Mm. So he has this very elegant honey cake with a raisin jam and a honey cream that we have in the book. So that's an example of the changes and the adaptations that recipes are taking on these days.
Before I let you go, I did want to ask about the title of your cookbook, Dobre Dobre. What does that mean and why choose that as the title?
So Dobre Dobre means good, good. But the full phrase is Dobre Dobre Nie za słodkie, which means good, good, not too sweet. And this is a Polish compliment for a cake or a pastry. Mm. And I love it because it's a little counterintuitive to the American way of thinking, which is we want our desserts as sweet as possible. And a lot of Polish desserts, it's about letting a seasonal fruit shine or getting a bit of a sweet crunch from streusel. And so it's a bit of a different philosophy around baking. And I love that.
That's writer and baker Laurel Kratochwila. Her latest cookbook is Dobre Dobre, Baking from Poland and Beyond. Thank you so much for talking with us. And I'm just going to have to go see if I can run to a bakery before my next interview. You made me so hungry.
Thanks, Carolyn.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. That's also where you can find the recipe for that yummy Polish apple cake we just heard about. Carolyn Beeler is back with us tomorrow. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
From PRX.